So, good morning, everybody. So, in our current Sunday morning sermon series, we've reached the third chapter of Daniel. And it's a very well-known Bible story, at least if you're of a certain age, you've probably heard it before. But before I really launch into the story about the fiery furnace, let's just recap on how God has been at work on King Nebuchadnezzar, who was the powerful king of Babylon, and he'd conquered Judah, and he'd taken many of the Jewish people into exile. Nebuchadnezzar thinks he is all-powerful, and he thinks he's in control of everything. But God is progressively showing him that, in fact, he, the king, is merely part of God's much greater plans. In chapter 1, which you remember was Richard's last sermon here, Nebuchadnezzar had found, when questioning the four bright young Jewish exiles who had been selected to integrate with the customs and culture of Babylon, that there were in fact none equal, and that in every matter of wisdom and understanding, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters in his whole kingdom. But Nebuchadnezzar did not know, in fact, that God had provided them with this wisdom and understanding. And that was because of their obedience and devotion to him, and also particularly obedience in terms of having resisted eating the unclean royal food and wine. And then in chapter 2, over the last 2 weeks we've heard, it's one of those four exiles, Daniel, who succeeds in doing what none of the Babylon cohort of wise men could do, and interpret Nebuchadnezzar's troublesome dream. But Daniel makes it absolutely clear, before he starts the interpretation, that it is his God in heaven, and not men, including himself, who reveals mysteries. And when the dream has been explained, it seems like the penny has finally dropped for Nebuchadnezzar. He says, "Surely your God is the God of gods and the Lord of kings and a revealer of mysteries, for you were able to reveal this mystery." But unfortunately, this was not followed up in his action at the start of chapter 3, because he sets up an enormous public statue, an image, and decrees that everyone must worship it. Now, it must have been a really impressive piece of work. It was plated with gold and displayed in a big open space where it stood 90 feet high. To give you some idea of that, everyone familiar with this? You live up in the northeast, you'll be very familiar with it. That's the Angel of the North. And by comparison, the Angel of the North is 66 feet high. So the statue of Nebuchadnezzar is 90 feet high. So it's about half as tall again as the Angel of the North. And if you look at the bottom of the picture, you can just about see some people. So compared to how it must have looked for an ordinary person, it would have been huge. Just as a quick sort of preview of where we're going with this, the Angel of the North is made out of 208 tons of steel. And steel is a thing that you'll hear more about as we go forward. So that is what the statue is meant to look like, but of course that's just an artist's impression, there are no pictures. And the statue is generally believed to be of the Babylonian god Nabu. And his name, the god's name, was the first part of the king's name. Nebuchadnezzar is generally understood to mean, "Nabu, protect my son." So to some extent, it's almost like the god that Nebuchadnezzar will identify with most. So how can we explain the inconsistency between the king's declaration to Daniel after the interpretation of the dream, "Surely your God is the God of gods," and his creation of this statue, which he commanded everybody to fall down and worship? The answer is that Nebuchadnezzar understood the power and wisdom of Daniel's God, but he was not prepared to receive him as the one and only God. That would have been too big a step for someone who was the guardian of the Babylonian beliefs and culture. In keeping with the Babylonian beliefs, Nebuchadnezzar was polytheistic. That means he worshipped many gods. So it was perfectly compatible for him to add Daniel's god, Yahweh, to his existing collection of gods. And evidently, Yahweh was by no means the most important, because it was Nabu who was represented by this mighty golden image. Now, unlike most outdoor sculptures that we see, for example, the Angel of the North, this statue was not there to improve the ambience of a public space. It was a statement of control, of what the public must believe in and worship. And it was backed by a heavy-handed decree of obedience. Throughout history, powerful regimes have used public art as a means of controlling the beliefs of the people and forcing their loyalty. It was a particular feature of communist regimes of the 20th century around the world, and large statues of the great leader usually abounded in public spaces, in town squares. Hang on. So I took this picture a few years ago. That's Lenin in a town square in Russia. Because about 15 years ago, my work took me to visit several times a particular remote city in the Ural Mountains called Magnitogorsk. Now, steel making has been in the news recently because of the decision to close the blast furnaces in Port Talbot in Wales. Magnitogorsk was a city that only really came into being in the 1920s when the Communist Party leadership decided that Russia desperately needed to industrialise rapidly. So they ordered the construction of a new giant iron and steel works in this place, which really was just a hill in the steppes. The actual name, Magnitogorsk, is in two part words. Magneto means like magnetite, iron ore, and Gorsk means hill. So it's literally, it was just hill of iron ore. And they built this enormous steel works there. And by the way, the process technology to build it actually came from the West. It was people from Sheffield and some people from America actually came and taught them how to do it. That is the works entrance. And what's interesting there is that kind of in the elevated high up positions, those kind of circles you can see, you kind of have images of Lenin and the Soviet Union symbolism on the right, the hammer and sickle. And they're kind of surrounded in sort of golden, you know, golden trim. But further down, those big friezes on the two sides, they are the workers. And they are kind of more lowly. And if you look, there's, you can just about pick it out, but the one on the left of the screen, they're kind of wielding a shovel. And on the right, they're wielding a giant spanner. So it's almost like you workers are serving us, the great state and the great leaders. Now, I actually had a few tours inside the works, and that is one of their newer plants. And that's what kind of red-hot metal looks like. The particular reason for showing you this slide, though, is can you see off to the left, there's kind of like a screened-off room, and there's some people in there. And that is called the control room. And the control room runs the plant, because as you'll appreciate, it's incredibly hot when you're looking at molten metal. So actually, the controllers have to be protected in a control room. And in front of them, there are control panels full of switches and dials and buttons and probably computer screens. Now, that image was in a much older control room for a different part of the plant. And in that control room, you actually have plaques on the wall. Again, it's the same imagery. It's the communist leaders. I think that's Lenin, top left. And they were kind of reminding the people, the workers in the control rooms, of actually why they were there. They were producing iron and steel for the purposes of the state. It kind of actually gets to them. It frames the purpose of their existence. And if you actually went into the steelworks, as I did from a safe distance, that's what you actually see. You know, that gives you some feeling of what the fiery furnace might have been like. That is molten liquid metal. On the right-hand side, there's some railway trucks down at the bottom of the picture. They're actually literally receiving molten metal poured out, iron, liquid iron, just running down. So, coming back to the story, it does take courage to stand up against pressure to conform to an authoritative system like communism, or even like the Ministry of Magic in the Harry Potter films. In fact, that image, which you may have seen if you've ever done the tour of the Legion Studios at Watford, that's what it looks like. And in a sense, they were taking their styling cues from the sort of communist kind of statues and sort of ideology. And those kind of statues, like the ones on the steelworks and like this one in the film, they're designed to make you feel like everybody else is kind of with you and they agree with you, and you collectively all agree with the system. So basically, you shouldn't really argue, you shouldn't be difficult, you should stand in line. And they create a sense of fear for those who object to the with the prospect of punishment as a dissident if you have any objections and speak out against it. And that is exactly what Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego must have been feeling. And as you commonly get under oppressive regimes, they were denounced and they were reported for not complying by those who had grievances against them. In this case, it was the astrologers. Very likely they were the same ones who'd been exposed and had their court positions undermined in the events of chapters 1 and 2. They had beef, they had an axe to grind. Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego, again we should remember, were living against their will in a foreign land, which would have been destabilising. Imagine how it feels sometimes if you're on if you've been on a foreign holiday, and maybe you go out alone, and you have a problem. Something happens, you lose something, you drop something, you injure yourself. And suddenly, you feel very exposed. You can't speak the language, you can't read the signs, and you don't quite understand the local customs or geography, how to get yourself home again. And that would have been exactly how they felt in this foreign land. But despite that, they clung on to their faith and its teachings, and they used that as their roadmap and compass. Uppermost in their minds would have been the Ten Commandments. Exodus 20, verses 3 to 5 says, "You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself an image in the form of anything in heaven above, or on the earth beneath, or in the waters below. You shall not bow down to them or worship them." So effectively, that's kind of the two commandments I put in that yellow circle at the top. King Nebuchadnezzar was insisting they disobey both of these commandments or else face a horrible death. So how courageous was their decision to defy him? They said, "King Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to defend ourselves before you in this matter. If we are thrown in to the blazing furnace, the God we serve is able to deliver us from it, and he will deliver us from your majesty's hand. But even if he does not, we want you to know, your majesty, that we will not serve your gods or worship the image of gold you have set up." You can see for that, particularly the highlighted words in the middle there, "if not," they didn't really know for sure whether God would save them. It's easy for us to think, oh yeah, they were always going to be all right, because we only know the story in its entirety. But put yourself with them in that moment. They didn't know. They really didn't know. But they did have faith. What they effectively had faith in was that whatever happened, God was in control of their destiny, and not Nebuchadnezzar. And of course, that enraged the king, because he thought he was all-powerful. So in response, he sentenced them to be thrown into the fiery furnace. And it says, he ordered the furnace to be heated 7 times hotter than usual. Now again, if you're kind of interested in industrial process, you think, well, how could they do that? How could you heat it up to 7 times its normal operating thing? You know, you couldn't do that on your central heating at home, could you? And I think there's two parts to that. One is 7 times is more the symbolic 7 that you see all the way through the Bible. But clearly it was much hotter than it would be normally. But there is actually an explanation, which is that if there had been a plant control room like in the steelworks, the operators would have been instructed to hit the on button for all seven sets of bellows, which were forcing air into the kind of the heated chamber. Essentially, by pushing in air, you can fan the flames and raise the temperature. So they really kind of cranked it up to a kind of almost crazy level. So naturally, when Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were thrown into the furnace, the king was expecting their instant deaths. I think it would almost have been by vaporization, because the furnace was just so hot that the flames killed the soldiers who took them up. As a quick aside, that feels rather, or seems rather cruel and unjust. These kind of innocent soldiers kind of got killed with it. But to the king, they were probably just expendable. He'd have seen them as collateral damage, to use that rather awful phrase that you hear in the news. But there was a little bit of a teaching there, that in truth, everybody, at some stage, should actually find it within them to resist serving the evil works of a tyrant. It's a kind of similar situation if you think about those kind of, occasionally in the news, you get these kind of guards from the Nazi concentration camps from the Second World War, who are still being prosecuted, even though most of them have died now. Yes, they were doing what they were told, but you have to own some of the responsibility of what you're doing. So King Nebuchadnezzar was amazed at what he saw. Far from being vaporized, these men were walking around in the fire, unbound and unharmed. But amazingly and weirdly, there were four of them when only three people had been thrown in. And he observed, to quote, "The fourth looks like a son of the gods." That's gods in the plural. I mean, that's just amazing, isn't it? In the most distressed moment, when they were staring at a cruel, imminent death, God had saved the three faithful people. And he's not only saved them physically, but he'd sent an angel to reassure them mentally and emotionally. God had seen their faithfulness and cared for them in even the most dire situation. To King Nebuchadnezzar, the figure was like a son of the gods. He understood it was divine. And being a believer in many gods, he probably imagined that the God of Israel, Daniel's God, had sent one of his sons, who was also divine. But probably Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego might well have seen it more from the point of view of a psalm, a well-known psalm, Psalm 91. I'm going to read out more verses that are on the screen there, but that kind of captures it. Psalm 91, verse 9 says this: "If you say, 'The Lord is my refuge,' and you make the Most High your dwelling, no harm will overtake you. No disaster will come near your tent. For he will command his angels concerning you to guard you in all your ways. They will lift you up in their hands so that you will not strike your foot against a stone." Now those words might sound familiar because actually they are the ones that the devil tempted in the wilderness. But in the context here, God was their refuge, and he had sent angels to guard, or an angel to guard, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And in a parallel to not striking your foot against a stone, not a hair of their heads had been singed. Once again, the one true God was showing King Nebuchadnezzar who really had power and control over everything. And the king was forced to acknowledge it. He said, "Praise be to the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and rescued his servants. They trusted in him and defied the king's command and were willing to give up their lives rather than serve or worship any god except their own god. Therefore, I decree that the people of any nation or language who say anything against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be cut into pieces and their houses be turned into piles of rubble. For no other God can save in this way. So the king was clearly greatly impressed by what had happened, but we should still know that he did not honour God as the only God. All this decree actually says is that the God of Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego should be respected and not slandered. It doesn't mean I actually accept him as my God and I accept him as my only God. So it's all cranking up the process, but it still doesn't get him all the way. Now, I said a little bit about control rooms earlier. That's the other kind of theme that's running through this talk. I want to think about control rooms. That one is the NASA control room in the Space Center for the Apollo missions. That's why the tech looks a little bit kind of dated. But also interesting to note that there's an American flag on the wall. So control rooms are like nerve centres. You get them where you're managing things in that are kind of remote from and have to be managed from a different, from a distance. They're like nerve centres, and they kind of send signals to directing actions. And those decisions are made by the operators in the control room, affecting things that are much wider than that, that go beyond it. Let's just think about our minds. Our minds are the equivalent of control rooms for our bodies. We have free will. God has given us free will. And it's in our minds that actually that's the place where we make choices. We send the nerve signals to the parts of the body where we want to take action. Is that familiar? That's the Disney Pixar film, Inside Out, which actually is a wonderful illustration of what I've just been saying. If you haven't seen it, I'd certainly recommend it. So the whole film takes place in the mind of a small girl called Riley. And in her mind, there were five emotions constantly competing with one another to operate the control panel, which you can see on the right-hand image there. And that control panel determines their actions. So there are five emotions. There are joy, and there's anger, and disgust, and fear, and sadness. And amongst those five emotions, joy acts as the leader, and she tries to limit the influence of sadness. Joy sees purpose in fear, disgust, and anger, but she just thinks that sadness worsens everything. The challenge from our reading this morning is to remember what, as Christians, should always be the primary influence in the control centres of our minds. In the film Inside Out, it's the emotion joy that tries to manage everything. And although it is good for us to be joyful, in isolation, this is just an emotion that cannot always be sustained. But our God is always there in our lives, regardless of how we're feeling. He guides us and protects us. His image should be imprinted front and center on the control room wall of our minds, if you go with my metaphor. So it's always there for us to reference every time we make the decisions that control the actions of our daily lives. Kind of a parallel, I don't know if they're still popular, but do you remember those What Would Jesus Do kind of wristbands? Same thing really, just having a visible representation on your wrist. But I'm kind of saying, you know, where you've got the American flag or where you've got the images of communist leaders, that's kind of front and centre in your minds and something you reference every time you should be making decisions. Question is, how true is that for us? Do we actually do that? Do we seek God in every choice that we make? I'd just like to finish off on a more personal note. Many of you will know for the last few weeks have been a really difficult time for myself and for Jackie, my wife. You'll know about that if you're on the prayer chair. And at this point, I just want to thank many of you in the St. Mark's Church family for upholding us in your prayers. We really feel the difference and for just blessing us with a continuing stream of kind actions which hasn't yet stopped. And we are truly thankful for all that you're doing for us. But I did think about these events whilst preparing this talk, because my reflection is that I've been through a situation, probably for the first time in my life, certainly in my adult life, where actually, in the control room of my mind, there were no buttons or switches I could press to actually try and rescue the situation for Jackie. It was outside my hands. Only God could do that. And I felt powerless. But he did hear the cry of my heart. And as with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, he was present with us in the most dire situation. And actually, he protected and rescued the both of us. This is really quite personal. Let us pray. Father, I thank you for your unchanging, steadfast love towards us, whatever we are feeling. And I thank you that you are always there as our rescuer and our redeemer. Fill our hearts with such love for you that your presence is always front and centre in our minds, directing our choices and our actions to build your kingdom in this world. In Jesus' name, amen.